Dharma Access, a podcast where we hear stories from BIPOC teachers about their Dharma experiences and practice, and how these inform the ways they are sharing the Dharma today. I am Sister Peace, your host for this episode, and joining me today is Dr. Ava Avalos. Ava was ordained as a Dharma teacher in 2018 after over 20 years of study in Zen practice. She facilitates the Sadisa Sangha in Botswana, the first African Sangha established in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh on the continent. Originally from San Diego, California, for the last 22 years, she has worked as an HIV-TB specialist physician and AIDS activist in Africa. In addition to clinical care, she focuses medical research on optimizing treatment for HIV/AIDS patients, preventing the development of HIV drug resistance, and improving implementation of public health programs. Additionally, Ava has extensive training with Rodney Yee and Colleen Sedman from New York in yoga teaching and training. And she also does her best to keep up with her two high-spirited pups. She paints, yoga, and dances as often as she can. Welcome, Dr. Ava Avalos.
Thank you, Sister Peace. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Beautiful, beautiful. So I want to just jump right out of the blocks with the first question that we'd like to have you address, which is, how do you identify racially, ethnically, and any other categories of social location that are of importance to you right now?
Well, I consider myself Latinx, you know, a Mexican-American from California. My parents, my ancestors, on my father's side were from Chihuahua, Tarahumara Indians, indigenous from Mexico. My mother's family from Mazatlan, and they were half French. So in Mexico, you know, Mazatlan is right on the ocean. So I think it was an area that was, you know, Mexican, Spanish, and French. So that's my mother's side. My father's side is indigenous. But I've been living in Africa for the past 22 years. So that certainly has expanded my sense of culture to you know, Mexican culture, American culture, and African culture. I would say those are, I can identify and you know, again, just begin to understand African culture. I've been here 22 years, but really it's just a minute in the big scheme of things. But what it has done is help me to connect to my ancestors more deeply, my heritage more deeply, and in many ways really mixed inside of me the whole idea of what it means to cross cultures internally and externally. Sorry, that was a long answer, but I hope it made sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I also, you know, wanted to just mention that in addition to you leading the Dharma there, you've also invited teachers from all over the world to come to Botswana. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and the retreats that you host there?
Well, yeah, it's been actually an incredibly wonderful experience to be able to invite the monastics from Plum Village, really since 2006, almost a tour every couple of years. And we've hosted you, what, now three times? And, of course, Sister Jewel has, you know, come many times. And Larry Ward and Peggy and Brother Baltic, Brother Fat Blue. It's really so many. And it's always wonderful. It's such a mutual learning and a real wonderful exchange. So I've been really so excited to share not just the Dharma, but the Dharma in Plum Village tradition, because I think it has been very, very helpful, because there are other Buddhists on the continent, but I think that the practice from Thai is very much more accessible in some ways for the general public to appreciate and understand, maybe a bit more open. And I think that's been really helpful. And thank you. And when are you coming back?
Hopefully soon. In fact, I wanted you to talk about considering having retreats and opening up invitation for others to come to Africa. So whether they're in the Plum Village tradition or any tradition, so that there's an opportunity for our BIPOC practitioners to touch the mother continent with the awareness of the Dharma.
Yeah, that's a dream that we've talked about for a long time that's now really taking shape. And with my dear friend Rahina from London, who's also OI and on her way to being a Dharma teacher herself, we're looking forward to hosting BIPOC teachers for a big retreat in 2024. And we're hoping that that attracts a lot of people really from around the world to come and to touch down in Africa and to experience the vitality and the beauty of this continent. I just got back tonight from Cape Town and the Botanical Garden there, right there at Table Mountain. And I can only tell you that it is, you know, one step away from heaven. And the land itself speaks to you and sings to you. And it's just beautiful. And I really look forward to being able to share that with the teachers and with the students.
Wow, beautiful. And we'll make sure that we put some links along with this podcast for those who may want to stay in touch with you about possibly coming there and visiting and practicing the Dharma there. And I can just say briefly from personal experience, being on the continent and practicing and having the awareness of the Dharma has been a life-changing event for me as well. So I'm very, very grateful for that. You mentioned, I just want to our listeners hear you say that you're an OI. I thought maybe you'd explain a little about that and about your Dharma name, Chan Hanbi.
Okay. So, so when I say OI, I'm referring to the Order of Inner Being, which is an ordination that has to do with the 14 mindfulness trainings. If some of you are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh's work, there's the 5 mindfulness training, the 5 precepts. But for those people that feel called to take that to a deeper level, then you can also commit to practicing the 14 mindfulness trainings and really becoming a member of the Order of Inner Being, which Thai created in the midst of great social upheaval in Vietnam to address what was happening there during the war. And it's you know, started off with 5 members, and now there's thousands of people that practice together. So it's a wonderful global movement of practice, a beautiful practice. So when you take those vows, you become an OI member. So I can't, to be honest, I don't remember when I took those vows, but my ordination, which allowed me to become a Dharma teacher, and the ordination, you're given a Dharma. Well, actually, OI, you're given a Dharma name, isn't it? So Chan Hanbi means true compassion in action. So I love that. And I love that I'm a Han as well. So it was a really special name. And and you know, compassion, you know, which is in many ways the hallmark of Buddhism, is so deep, is something that one never can exhaust. We can never exhaust compassion. So it's a beautiful reminder that when action is graced with compassion, things always go in a much better direction. So that's a great learning for me that I try to practice regularly.
Talking about juxtaposition, you have this beautiful practice of yoga, dance, art, mindfulness, and medicine. Tell me how that has helped you with your practice. And is this an edge of your teaching when you are sharing with others?
Well, thank you. That's a beautiful question. It is my practice. That is my practice. My work is my practice. And I'm really fortunate because I love being a doctor. And I studied dance, and I studied dance at UCLA for many years. I have my undergraduate and graduate degree in dance before I went to medical school. And I've been a very lucky person. I've been very, very lucky in my life, and to be able to have experienced really two different sides, usually that don't come together, and they should, because they are in many ways like so complementary in all ways. Let's say in all ways complementary. And it's one of the reasons that has motivated me to stay in Africa for 22 years, because African culture is much closer to that understanding and that realization. And you know, we sing and we dance, and it's part of the culture. It's every day still part of the culture. So to be a doctor and a dancer in Africa makes perfect sense. So I knew that, you know, in that sense, my work and my understanding is welcome and at home. So again, I've just been very, very fortunate that life unfolded in such a way that I could continue to enjoy life on that level. And I can tell you that, you know, I'm an HIV physician, and I do a lot of public health work. I couldn't do that work without a practice. It was because of the practice that I have been allowed to really serve, serve as a physician, serve as a public health specialist, and to be able to contribute to the national HIV response on the level that I have for so many years. So if it wasn't for the practice, I could never do any of that. So I'm very grateful.
Wow, that's extraordinarily profound. You know, when I hear you talk about the way that you practice your yoga, your dance, your medicine, all the things that are creative outlets, one could even say creative healing, I wonder if you would share with us how you share the practice with the beautiful young practitioners there in Africa, and what parts of the practice have been most particularly helpful for them?
That's another wonderful question. You know, over the years, because we've really helped Sangha here for 20 years, there have been many people that have come through. But more recently, we've had a really strong core of most in their 20s and 30s that really are ready to commit to that practice and to that path. It's very difficult, you know, as far as Botswana is concerned. It's a Christian country, and that's deeply ingrained. And in some ways, I can relate to that as a Mexican American, you know, because when I went to Catholic school for 12 years, so that's really part of me. And so, you know, sometimes, not always, but sometimes some of the more conservative Christian churches are very, you know, are not open to the possibility of people exploring other religions or other traditions. And I had a young man, a very wonderful practitioner now, a very steady practitioner, say to me, "Listen, Ava, it was easier for me to tell my parents I was gay than to tell my parents that I was Buddhist." So it's hard for young people, you know, here, to be able to actually go deeply. They can certainly, and many do, come in and kind of see how it goes, but to actually commit to say, this is my path, is much more difficult. Like, and for instance, you know, we have a lot of people on our Facebook page, and that's, again, they will read the articles and they'll comment, but not so many that actually come to practice. But that's changing. More and more that's changing. And I think it's wonderful. You know, Botswana is a very young country. I think the average age is about 30. And, you know, it's global influence now, and everyone's talking mindfulness, you know, therapists and doctors. And so I really see that shift that's happened really over the last 5 years. So that's really, really wonderful and encouraging.
Wow. That is so beautiful. And just give us a sense of, because I know the practice there is maybe a little bit different than it is in other places. Just give us a sense of what a practice session is with your Sangha, or what you might do during a retreat.
Yeah, I think Sangha is in many ways very, you know, we usually have yoga. I think that's the one thing that, you know, we have a very much embodied practice, because yoga is kind of fundamental to that, because of my approach and as my teaching. But then, you know, we sit together, we pray together, we have our days of mindfulness. I'm very, very similar to the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. When we have retreats, though, we tend to sing and dance a lot more probably than others. And dancing is, you know, you just got to do it. And if you don't do it, sorry for you.
That is beautiful. And, you know, I have another question, which is, you've touched on it a little bit, but are there any other suggestions that you might have for how our communities could be more supportive of BIPOC practitioners and teachers in today's world?
In our tradition, in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh?
Sure.
Well, it's very interesting, you know, because Thich Nhat Hanh is not white.
Right.
You know, this is always the amazing thing to me.
It's true.
It's a BIPOC Sangha, because our leader is Vietnamese, and the vast majority of practitioners are Vietnamese. So it's very interesting when that gets turned around as though it's not. In fact, you know, it's because Thai was Vietnamese that I could listen. And because Thai, from the beginning, talked about the importance of inclusion. And the very first retreat I went to had, had an emphasis on people of color. You know, Larry Ward and Peggy was, they were my first Dharma teachers that I ever encountered. And it was all about inclusion. And it always has been, and it always will be. You know, I think people could get confused. What's a nice way of saying it, of their whiteness, maybe, of believing that they are the dominant culture, even when they're not in cultures where they are the dominant ones. You know, it's confusion.
Yeah,
because our tradition is a BIPOC tradition. You know, so we can't forget that. We can't forget who Thai is. You know, if other people are confused, that's okay, but we shouldn't be confused about it. And I think it's important, again, in Africa, that even my Americanness doesn't get in the way of just the relationship between the Vietnamese culture and African culture. You know, we don't need a translator. We don't need an American translator, right? And I think that's really important, you know, as a teacher and as even as BIPOC. I always tell the story of, you know, when I came to Botswana, and, you know, even now, if you're not black, people think you're white.
Wow.
So this is the only place in the world that I've ever been treated as a white person. Wow. And they'll say, I'm not white, you know, I'm Mexican, and I'm Mexican-American. Mm. And that's been a really good lesson for me, because I have to remember that, and I have to behave appropriately. So I have to, even as somebody perceives me as behaving in a dominant Western, you know, way, I work hard not to remember to respect the culture that I'm in, and to be respectful to the people that I'm around, and to let go of some of that. Some of it I can't. I mean, I'm also an American, so I can't let go of all of it. But to be able to be deeply aware of how I can be perceived. And then, you know, the second I land in, you know, wherever I land back in United States, I'm Mexican again. I'm Mexican American. So they're good lessons.
Those are very deep lessons. Thank you, Ava, for us to be mindful of as we move in our communities, and also lessons that could be shared by those in our communities to other communities where the majority perhaps is not BIPOC, although, of course, every stream of Buddhism attracts every stream of people. And we just being very aware that the practice is to know that there is majority, but that also let us all be as mindful as you of our place in whatever space that we happen to be in. So grateful for that.
It's deep. It's something I think that we definitely need to talk about more. And maybe that's the answer to your question, that this is something that we engage with in a community much, much more. Particularly those practitioners who are from the West, you know, because sometimes they don't may not feel comfortable addressing BIPOC issues for whatever reason, but they need to. We all need to, so that we can help people to understand really, you know, how the practice can allow one to move into spaces to heal them, you know, to be able to feel comfortable. I hope that makes sense. I wanted to say something about, I think as we cross cultures, it's a challenge. And it's a challenge in the sense that, and I see this happen in our communities at times, where people believe that they need to act in a way that's much more reflective, not of their own culture, but of possibly Vietnamese culture, right? That suddenly everybody talks really softly, and you know, it's not real, right? And I think that's, again, that's something that we have to be able to say, no, it's okay for me to be, you know, a loud, strong, passionate Mexican, because that's who I am. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm mean or that I'm, you know, or I act in dominating ways. But I know that I can't whisper when I'm talking. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
And I think that people get very confused about that.
Right.
And sometimes if they come into that, they don't feel like they're in the right place.
Ah, ha. Huh. Interesting. You know, I wonder, and it probably does have some application in many different lineages, because for most of us, the lineages that we are attracted to are not American, quote unquote. They are Tibetan, Theravadin, Thich Nhat Hanh, Soto, Zen. It's so many different ones. And that is definitely something to have an awareness of as we move through our communities.
Right. And ultimately, the practice should make us more authentic and allow us to celebrate our authenticity and our uniqueness and our beauty in that way, you know. And that's why there's so many different paths that one can take, you know, that there's so many different traditions for us to find our true home.
Finding our true home. Thank you for saying that, because the question I wanted to ask, I think it would be very interesting, is how did you find the Dharma as your true home?
Oh, gosh, Sister Peace. That's a long story. yeah, that's quite a question in my evolution, in my journey. You know, I'm Mexican American. I was raised Catholic, and I went to Catholic school for all the 12 years of my education. So a sense of spirituality was there, although I was never quite convinced, even as a young child, that maybe it was the right path for me, or maybe the right path at all. And so really early on, I was a curious child and a curious adolescent, and I wanted answers. And so when I was 15, I would sneak off with my best friend, Francetta Machete. We'd tell our parents we were going to basketball games or football games, and we would go to a yoga institute and do yoga. I wasn't even driving yet. So I was only 15 at the time. And that, unbeknownst to me, the yoga studio that I went to was a center for the infamous Indian guru, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And so that sent me on a 10-year odyssey of becoming a disciple of Rajneesh, going to India when I was 19. And really experiencing, unfortunately, the most difficult things in my life. I was involved in it. For those of the people that know what happened with Rajneesh, I was involved in it deeply. It became cult-like, toxic community. So, and I was involved in it as anybody could have been, and actually ended up going to the FBI. As things disintegrated, and really was very, very lucky to have been able to see through a lot of the things that when early on I couldn't see. And again, that's enough for a whole podcast in and of itself. But what's important is that I was able somehow, through the grace of the universe, to get back on my feet. And to continue my spiritual journey, even though at the time my trust was really, had been really shaken. So I was able to go back to school and go back to college. And in college, I took a history of Buddhism class. And that was when I was first introduced to Thich Nhat Hanh's work, the reading list. And I had to read the books. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, here's an incredible teacher. But because I had been so hurt, my trust had been so damaged, I read Thay's books for 10 years before I had the courage to actually go and see him. I went to a lecture in Los Angeles, and he walked on the stage, and I thought, yep, he's my teacher. And so since that time, I've been able to benefit so greatly with the community and Thay's wisdom. An understanding of practice and what it means. And also, I was able to really understand what had happened to me as a young woman, a young girl, getting involved in a cult, and how I could get through that suffering and contextualize that suffering. It was so, so important. I never would have been able to have forgiven myself for what I had gotten myself involved in, or understood it in a bigger way. It was Thay's great teaching of the art of suffering that really saved my life.
Thank you so much, Ava, for sharing so much in depth your journey towards the Dharma and how it was able to help you grow and to heal. And I know that the community of the Dharma is really lucky to have you in it as a result. This thought I'd ask you, if you have any closing words or thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be with you today, Sister Peace. I think it's always good to reflect deeply on, you know, where you've come from and kind of where you're going. I think that my work has really evolved. I started off as a dancer and a yoga teacher, and went to medical school and have done that really straight ahead medicine for a long time, public health. Really since COVID, when I really, the blessing for me with COVID, the dividends, somebody was talking about the dividends of COVID. And I think that all of us have to reflect on, especially coming out of that pandemic, what were our lessons? But for me, it was really delving again into yoga, into intensive study of advanced yoga, and being able to synthesize in a way that I had never before embodied practice and embodied consciousness and understanding that in the context of a doctor, a medical doctor, but also as a Dharma teacher, and how important embodied practice is, how much embodied practice is needed now, and how it can profoundly take your understanding and experience of life forward. So I think that's, you know, maybe my closing words is to really encourage people that feel that alienation from their bodies or feel that disembodied, how important it is to find embodied practice, to allow yourself to befriend yourself and to enjoy the miracle of embodiment, which is really Thay's message, right? The miracle of mindfulness, the miracle of being on this planet manifested at this, you know, particular time that is really intense and is really stressful, but it's by being able to appreciate oneself, one's embodied self, that we can find the resilience and the strength and courage and hope to fully appreciate and make the most of life on the planet. And that's like a deep kind of healing that comes, again, with embodied practice.
Thank you so much. We've had the honor of sharing with Dr. Ava Avalos, Dharma teacher in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh and Plum Village, and how the Dharma has come to her, what she's experienced, how she teaches. We're so grateful. Thank you, Dr. Avalos, for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Sister Peace. I love you.
This has been Sister Peace, your host for this episode of Opening Dharma Access with Dr. Ava Avalos, sharing her Dharma experience as a BIPOC teacher. Look for new episodes on the first Tuesday of every month. In between episodes, we'll also share a meditation, mindfulness practice, chant, or another form of practice from our guest with you. Come back to share these practices and to keep on listening to our BIPOC teachers. Be sure to subscribe for notifications and review the podcast to help us spread the word. Check the episode notes for resources and email us at suddenleap.a to z@gmail.com with any questions you may have. Let's open Dharma access to all beings.